Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, good morning. We are here on two rules petitions. The first one, 1602A, I have as the only speaker, Attorney Thomas Schreiner. Is that correct? Okay. Is there anybody else that wants to speak on this petition? Okay, very good. Are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
After the submission, and I'll say they were helpful. I think we've improved what we had last time around, and I certainly don't intend today to go through everything again that you heard a year ago, unless you have particular
questions. I'm sorry. Is the microphone loud enough? Go ahead. I'm sorry, Mr. Schreiner.
It's not working. I'll speak more loudly.
I opened one of the...
All right.
Things up here, and it's better. Thank you.
This is the last piece of a long-term project that the Council and its Evidence and Civil Procedure Committee, which I chair, had going back to before the time I was on the Council, so at least 6 or 7 years ago, when at the suggestion of Professor Dan Blinka of the Marquette University Law School, that a number of aspects of the rules of evidence, which had been adopted 30-plus years ago, might need some update. We took that on as a project. This is the end of it. And if I may...
Why you say the words, this is the end of it? We usually wait until the end of the proceeding to say thank you to the Judicial Council for its fine work. But I didn't want this opportunity to pass without my saying not only thank you for this fine work, although there will be, I'm sure, comments on it, but for all of the Judicial Council fine work. And as you know, but many might not, this court, a majority of this court, favored not supporting financially the Judicial Council.
Okay, now that is not the subject of this hearing, Justice Abrahamson, but others have questions on this, and I'd like you to look at 90608.
Okay,
I have a question, and the question I have is
why... Sorry to be interrupted in this way.
Well,
but
I am sorry
complete.
That you are not adhering to the noticed hearing. Please
oh,
see
I
it
am
right now.
Adhering to the noticed okay. hearing, which relates to the Judicial Council, and I note that April Southwick
attorney,
was to be
attorney
a speaker, but
Schreiner,
she's not.
Attorney Schreiner, this is not a public forum for your private gripes, Shirley Abrahamson.
This is not
I
a
have
private
a question
gripe. It's
that
a gripe
relates
in an order
to 90608. And the question
this,
I have
Schreiner.
Is why the change from the federal rules, which we tend to adhere to, unless there's a very good reason not. And my concern is with the word credibility. In the federal rules, it's more fully stated, but evidence of truthful character is admissible only after the witness's character for truthfulness is attacked. And so I think that the petition before us shortens up the federal rule and just uses credibility. And I guess I was wondering why the change.
And this is in sub?
It's in 906.08. Sub 1, and in the federal rules, it would be 608 parent A parent.
We have not proposed a change to 90608 sub 1 in this petition.
Okay.
So the language that the you refer to, Chief Justice, is in the existing 90608 sub 1. And I think it gets at the difference, which I'm sure we didn't articulate well last year, between credibility and character for truthfulness. And if I may, I think Professor Blinka's memorandum, which is submitted as an appendix to our memo in support of the petition, explains it better than I can. But the way I think of it is, credibility is a broad term. It encompasses a number of ways that a witness's testimony can be attacked and expressed to the trier of fact as should not be believed. It includes, obviously, a suggestion that the witness may be lying, which, as Professor Blinka points out, a lot of attention is addressed to, but it is not usually the way in which a witness's credibility is attacked. More commonly, it attacks the bases of credibility, which have nothing to do with telling the truth, with the dishonest, with the liar, but rather with the honest but mistaken witness who either didn't perceive it correctly, has forgotten it, can't articulate it. All of that goes to credibility. And so when 90608.1 uses the phrase, the credibility of a witness may be attacked or supported by evidence in the form of reputation or opinion, normally, of course, it couldn't be without 90608.1. So any of those is potentially subject to attack in the form of reputation or opinion, but 90608 sub 1A points out that opinion testimony may refer only to character for truthfulness or untruthfulness, not to the other ways in which credibility is.
Counsel, but credibility, when you hear that determination made, can be broad enough to say that the statement is accurate. Okay, so if you're comparing the statement of person A and the statement of person B, if you say A's statement has credibility, it goes more than to whether that person is truthful or has a good recollection. It goes to the accuracy of the statement, and that's what's bothering me.
Well, I think, if I may, and I don't express this as well as I think Professor Blinka does in his memo.
That's Appendix 1.
Please?
That's in Appendix 1.
Right, Appendix 1 to the memo.
Yes.
And what
you can answer.
What I get to is credibility is a broad term, but 08 and 09 are specifically directed to character for truthfulness. They are, and 90608 sub 1A makes clear that although credibility may be attacked by opinion testimony, it may only be attacked if it goes to the character for truthfulness of the witness.
Well, the way I read,
so you think this is a limitation, that there is a limitation because of the topic of the section?
Yes, because it has to do with opinion testimony as to character.
Okay.
And it has to do also with the extent to which extrinsic evidence may be used. Extrinsic evidence may be used, our proposed 90616 goes to this, and is commonly used on the other elements of credibility. You certainly can bring in extrinsic evidence, you bring in other witnesses' testimony, any other kind of evidence to establish that the witness is biased, that the witness is mistaken, that the witness was using drugs at the time. I mean, any of the other things that go to a credibility. It's only with respect to opinion testimony on character for truthfulness that extrinsic evidence is barred. And that's really what 90608 sub 1 sets up.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Schreiner, correct me if I'm wrong. It appears that we're assuming that the term credibility encompasses two discrete concepts. One, a willingness to tell the truth, and two, the ability to tell the truth. Is that accurate?
It encompasses both, certainly. And I guess what I'm suggesting, and again, I get this from Professor Blinka, who's studied this a lot longer than I have, the bigger element of credibility is ability to tell the truth.
Okay,
ability,
so
because the witness didn't really actually perceive it correctly, or has forgotten it, or just can't articulate it correctly.
But when we talk about character for truthfulness, then we're talking about the willingness to tell the truth.
We're talking about liars. We're talking about going after people who, the suggestion will be, are liars because they have a reputation for being a liar, 90608, and one can have opinion testimony to that extent. Or 90609, this sort of institutionalized sense that someone who's been convicted of a crime is likely to be a liar.
Okay.
Because doesn't yeah. respect the law.
Yeah. So so your proposed swap in 90609 sub 1 and in sub 2 of character for truthfulness for credibility suggests that that evidence can only go to a person's willingness to tell the truth.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
That's all 90609 is about.
Does evidence of a prior conviction ever bear on a witness's ability to tell the truth?
No. And there's case law on that. It's discussed in the memorandum. Willingness, ability to tell the truth is always fair game. I don't think that the suggestion that someone is unable to tell the truth because of a prior conviction is something that arises, unless maybe the guy has been doped up for much of his life and during the period of time. I could certainly see where a witness's testimony that that he perceives something at a time when he's already been adjudicated to have been intoxicated could be, but that's a rare occasion. That isn't really what this addresses.
But if we swap out credibility in favor of character for truthfulness, we are limiting the kind. We're limiting the purpose for the admission of those prior convictions, right? So we would be eliminating those rare instances. That
with respect, it's already not in there. 90608 and 90609 are only about opinion testimony as to character for truthfulness. That's all they've ever addressed.
Right. Okay. So.
And by the way, the feds have already changed 608 and 609 to make these changes.
Right. But what you and it addresses that by virtue of our prior opinions, not the terms of the rule.
Well.
Because the terms of the rule say credibility.
Well,
and if credibility encompasses both willingness and ability, then currently the rule does say that this kind of information can be used to address the ability to tell the truth.
But the case law tends to restrict it because right. of the overriding concern of 90608 not to get into extrinsic evidence of someone's bad character. The rule already tends to restrict it to character for truthfulness. The word credibility in there as it is now is just confusing because
right.
it doesn't keep 08 and 09 to what they were intended to be and what the case law says they actually go to.
Well, you don't have to go to the case law because when you look at this, you can only give the number of convictions.
Right.
And you can't even say what the conviction is for.
That's right.
So you can't go through to that prior case and say, he lied because he couldn't see, or there was no light, but he testified anyway.
Well, if the witness is on the stand as the defendant.
That's right.
And tries to explain what the prior convictions were for, the witness then opens it up. But generally speaking, no. We have this rule of number, and one of the things we've proposed to clean up in 90609 is to put into code rather than case law the holding of State versus Gary M.B., both the court's opinion and the two dissenting opinions, to the effect that there ought to be an examination of the underlying cases before the court determines the number. And we've also taken out the language that used to say testify to the number and say testify to the number determined by the court so that we're not basically telling the witness to lie.
Tell me what you did about expungement.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. Tell me what you did about expungement. That's not in 2A through F.
expungement is in the federal rule. It's not in our rule because, in our view, expungement cannot be an expunged conviction cannot be referred to anyway because under the expungement statute, it's no longer a conviction.
All right. Thank you. Is this rule intended at all to impact or address 904.04 or 05?
No, those, or 03, those remain sort of the generic rules. 904.03 in particular has a part to play in the operation of 906.09 and 906.08 because you still need the ability to keep out things that will be a waste of time or unfairly prejudicial. But we don't suggest any change to 904.04 sub 2.
I mentioned that because the rules of evidence, as they deal with character evidence, and then evidence of truthfulness, and then specific instances of conduct, sometimes get all mixed up.
Oh, they do.
And so when you refer to character evidence, I just wanted to make sure you were buttoning that up with character for truthfulness.
Well, I think that's what we mean by character evidence. We often refer to it by shorthand. And with respect, I think the amendments we suggest, 906.08, will help in that respect because it does make clear the only kind of opinion evidence you can have with respect to character is to character for truthfulness. Not character for forgetfulness. You can bring in forgetfulness by other acts, but you can't have somebody testify, well, he has always had a good memory.
Except that's why I asked the question, because 904.04 is character evidence not admissible to prove conduct, exceptions, and then other crimes. And then 904.05 is methods of proving character.
Right.
So those remain intact.
Those remain the same.
Okay.
Those remain the same.
Counsel. If no one else has a question with regard to 906.08 sub 1, which there's no change, sub 2, or 906.09, I have a question with regard to the 901.07.
All right. We've tried to clean up the concern that the court had last time about the language of writing or recording, basically say, I think consistent with the common law, consistent with the common law of Wisconsin, that the rule of completeness extends to unrecorded statements when introduced for the purpose of typically impeaching a witness's testimony, statements that that witness may have made in the past, not in writing, most likely in a criminal case, but otherwise. And this rule now makes clear what the case law made before, which is that the relevant rest of the statement can be admitted, should be admitted if necessary, in order to, I forgot what language we used, in order for it to give a fair impression of, to provide context or prevent distortion.
Yes. First of all, let me say, with regard to the other provisions, 906.08 and specifically, please extend my thanks to Professor Blinka for his very helpful writing on this issue. Also extend, if you will, my thanks to April Southwick for her work. I note that she was listed on our roster for presenting today, but she isn't here. 901.07 causes me concern for a number of reasons, and it relates back to some of the discussion that we had at our prior hearing. You talk about unrecorded statements, and when you say unrecorded, what do you mean by recorded or unrecorded?
Reduced to writing, I think. Or
so written. Is that what
written
you mean?
Or taped. But let's say, and I think this probably happens in a criminal case more often, a witness, whether the defendant or not, a witness makes a statement to the police at the time of investigation, which isn't recorded. And that statement is used at trial. The witness is entitled under 90107, the rule of completeness, just as if this were a paragraph taken out of context, out of a contract, or out of an email, to have the rest of the statement, any other part that which ought, in fairness, to be considered contemporaneously with it to provide context or prevent distortion. Obviously, that is intended to and does, in its language, provide a good deal of discretion in the trial court as to how much to let in or not. It's not everything. I think one of the statements in one of the cases is that the Trojan horse doesn't bring the whole thing in. It's not a Trojan horse that brings the whole thing in. But as much of it as, in fairness, ought to come in.
Yes, and as I understand, the reason for this request for amendment is not with regard, really, to the written statements, but really focusing on oral statements.
My understanding.
Yeah. I'm concerned about the vetting of 90107. Can you explain to me the process of who really took a close eye at this?
Well, I hope everybody who had an interest in it. We certainly did everything we could to bring that about. First of all, we have representatives of the state public defender, of the attorney general, of the district attorney appointed by the governor on the council and participating in our deliberations. We also gave very broad dissemination to our proposed rule and to, first of all, the subject of the matter, and sought input before we got down to brass tacks and put it in the form of a proposed rule. We then circulated it widely, as we always do, to various associations of defenders and prosecutors and law enforcement and others. And we sent it out again before this hearing last year when we changed it. So, and we've had no objection.
Response, yeah.
No response at all.
Sometimes I think when everyone's responsible, no one's responsible, and I don't say that disrespectfully. It gave me quite a bit of confidence in the petition as amended in 90608 and 90609 to see that Professor Blinka went through it with a fine-tooth comb, apparently. And indeed, 90107, as I understand it, is in part to codify the common law, specifically State versus Eugenio.
Right.
And I had the honor of writing that unanimous opinion in 1998. And in that opinion, I cited, as I do on several occasions, Professor Blinka's work, because I find it so helpful. But I note that I don't have the same confidence with regard to 90107. And let me ask a few questions that might clear up my my cause for pause. First,
we have Professor Blinka, so you get more confidence out of my answer. But
indeed. First of all, let me start with the title. The title remains the same: remainder of or related writings or recorded statements.
We've stricken recorded here.
You've taken recorded out.
Second. Okay. Yeah,
recorded. Yes, thank you. You're absolutely correct. Where is anything about oral in that title? I mean, if the reason for this change is written or oral statements,
I don't know what else there is, but there, you know, with the ongoing development of communication, the prospect that there might be something out there that is neither written nor oral, I suppose, always has to be kept in mind. The idea
telepathic?
Well, it might be tweeted. It might be tweeted and
that's written.
It might be. It might be. It might be something that was there that went away because of the short shelf life of tweets or something. I don't know enough about tweets to answer.
Okay. It seems to me that the title is a little
wanting. But I can live with lack of perfection. I do it, you know. But a little wanting because of no reference to oral when this is all about oral statements. But what I had a concern about previously and I remain concerned about is what do you mean by recorded? The example that you gave was the officer taking a written statement pretrial. Does recorded mean... It does not necessarily mean that it has to be part of the record in terms of the record of a court proceeding.
No, it doesn't. The idea is reduced to some form that can be consulted with some confidence that it's an accurate reproduction of what was said, which could be a writing, it could be an audio or video recording. That's what we're doing. I mean, you're engaged in a legislative task in this sense. You're trying to foresee the future and what might come up, and we're trying to be a lot more inclusive of the types of statements that might occur than was the case in the past, where the world was all reduced to writing.
Well, so when whether recorded or unrecorded has been added, to the amended amendment.
I don't know the facts of Eugenio, but it occurs to me that it must have been somebody saying something and nobody writing it down and then someone testifying, mm-hmm. This is what the witness said.
Mm-hmm. It was a sexual assault of a child case. Mm-hmm. Right now, the amended petition states whether any part of a writing or statement, whether recorded or unrecorded, is introduced by a party. An adverse party may require the party at the time to introduce any other part or any other writing or statement, which ought in fairness to be considered contemporaneously with it to provide context, etc. I mean, I'm concerned since the whole thrust of this change is to address oral, to codify the common law on oral statements. There's no reference to the word oral whatsoever here for clarification, either in the title or the content. From my perception, it could be whether any part of a written or oral statement, and then not have whether recorded or unrecorded, because to me that clouds it. Recorded, what type of recording? By whom does the recording have to be? If I put the written statement in my desk drawer, is that a recorded statement?
Well, I think it is.
I think it is too.
Reduced to a permanent form, right? But chipped into granite or something. Or written on a piece of paper, or, right?
The writing is easy because that was covered by the prior law, right? That's the way. This amendment is to cover the oral statement, although the amendment says nothing whatsoever in its title or text about oral.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Although I don't think the title is misleading. It's a remainder of a related writing or statement.
What kind of statements? That's why it's the rule of incompleteness is incomplete in my mind.
Mr. Schreiner, perhaps this is a way to get through this. Can an unrecorded statement be anything other than an oral statement?
Well, not in my imagination now. So I can't think of anything else.
Yeah.
It's either recorded or it ain't. And if it ain't, then how else do we know about it other than somebody heard it? Now, you can imagine a situation, I suppose, in which an oral statement was made and the person who heard it made a note of it, which isn't attributable to the person who said it because the person who said it didn't write it down, where you could get into questions about refreshing the recollection of the challenging witnesses.
Then is that oral statement recorded? See, that's where you get into the problem.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost redundant. You mean to have written statement and oral statement. And then when you talk about an oral statement that's recorded, I suppose it can be recorded audio visually, but you just gave the example of an oral statement recorded by writing.
Somebody else.
Yeah, but I know.
And that's not the witness's statement.
Is a Snapchat or a tweet a written or an oral statement?
You're asking the wrong person.
Written.
Well, Snapchats disappear after a short period of time. I don't know how long tweets exist or not,
but
would they be included within this rule?
Well, it's sort of, somebody says, what do? You look at a Snapchat, you listen to it? I don't know.
Look at it.
You look at something that is ephemeral, and then it's gone, okay? It is not recorded because it's not recoverable in recorded form, so it's a statement.
Unless
somebody
there's a screenshot.
I'm sorry?
If there's a screenshot, it's recorded.
I don't know the answer to that. And again, I think it's wise to expand this beyond.
I know, but why do you need whether recorded or unrecorded? I have brackets around that phrase. Why can't it be when any part of a writing or statement is introduced?
Statement.
It could be recorded, could be not recorded. And to me, when I see recorded, I think of recording in the Register of Deeds office. Mm-hmm. And that's not what this means at all.
Well, I think it means whether it's been reduced to a permanent form or not.
Well, that won't work where we have forms that are not permanent. Emails aren't permanent either. They're deleted frequently.
Well, as a trial lawyer, I'll tell you, they live forever, Your Honor.
Well, you can find them forever by looking at that at the computer. But they can be erased.
I agree. But they seem to pop up at the worst possible time when you thought there wasn't anything left.
And a writing could be destroyed in a flood or a fire.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Yep.
Mr. Schreiner, and I don't mean to propose language and the alternative here, but just as a conceptual matter, I'm wondering if there was a way to simplify this, and perhaps you can tell me that there are obvious problems with this. Why wouldn't we just say when any part of a statement, whether written, oral, or otherwise, is introduced by a party?
Somebody might ask you what you mean by that, and I wouldn't be able to answer the question, so we weren't going to propose it. We meant by recorded or unrecorded to capture all three of those, whatever or otherwise might be at some time in the future.
Yeah.
And maybe we didn't do it, and obviously you can do with this what you want, but that's what we were responding to from last time. 90616, I guess we've gone over 0809. I can answer any questions you have. Yeah. 90616 is a uniform rule which is fully consistent with the common law of Wisconsin and consistent with the common law of the United States as reflected in State versus Long, a 2002 Court of Appeals opinion, and United States versus Abel, a 1984 U.S. Supreme Court opinion, to the effect, and I think really makes an important point, which we all know, I guess, except not everybody who starts practicing law knows everything we all know, and as well it seems to me to have 90616 there to say that credibility is always an issue, and it's always relevant. And that's essentially what this rule says. For the purpose of attacking the credibility of a witness, evidence of bias, prejudice, or interest of the witness for or against any party to the case is admissible. There it is in black and white.
I see that it is consistent with the uniform rule. Is there a federal rule that's parallel?
There is not. The feds have not adopted such. Well, Minnesota has, and that's the only one I know of for sure.
But just under the federal rules of evidence, there is no such rule parallel to 90616?
There is not. It is just the common law expressed in the United States versus Abel, or Abel versus the United States, whichever it is. I have nothing further to offer unless the court has more questions.
Very good. Thank you very much.
I have a comment, Mr. Schreiner.
Yes.
The Judicial Council lived without an executive director before, and I hope you and others will continue that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Difficult circumstances.
I'll pass that on. We're left in the situation where the Judicial Council continues to exist by law,
right,
and to have duties imposed by law.
I'm sure you saw the court order.
I'm now
going to
call
me.
The next proceeding that we have before us, 1609, in the matter of Supreme Court Rule 40.05. I have presenting Dennis Pudd, General Counsel, and as a speaker, Jacqueline Rothstein. Are there any other people who would like to appear on behalf of Rule Petition 1609? Yes. Your name, please?
Nicole.
I didn't hear.
H-O-M-E-R.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? Okay, very good. Would you please begin?
Justices, may it please the court. My name is Dennis Puz, Jr. I'm general counsel for the Stockbridge Muncie community. It's my honor to present Rule Petition 1609 to the court today on behalf of my client. The impetus for this rule petition is actually the hiring of a tribal prosecutor, Ms. Laura Vetter. We were thrilled to have her as an applicant. She had 7+ years of service in-house for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe in Minnesota, in multiple capacities from associate attorney to legal director. As most tribes do, we require any attorney that is hired by the tribe to either have a Wisconsin bar license or to achieve one within 6 months of being hired. Ms. Vetter attempted to waive into the bar through Supreme Court Rule 40.05, legal competence requirement, proof of practice. She received a letter of denial from the Board of Bar Examiners based on what we believe is a misapplication of this court's In Re Admission of Haugamo decision from 2002. This setback in Ms. Vetter's individual application prompted the Stockbridge Muncie community to file Petition 1609 to ensure no other tribe in Wisconsin's Indian Country or in-house attorney who's dedicated their career to serving tribal governments has the Haugamo decision misapplied. Rule Petition 1609 has a simple intent. It's to ensure that in-house practice with any federally recognized Indian tribe counts towards the proof of practice standard in Supreme Court Rule 40.05. The petition is consistent with the Board of Bar Examiners' August 30, 2001 final decision in Haugamo, where the board counted Ms. Haugamo's practice when she was licensed in Minnesota, but not the time she attempted to claim while representing tribes when she was not licensed in the state in which the tribe is located. Furthermore, this court also noted in its decision that the board counted the periods of time from the date Ms. Haugamo was admitted to the Minnesota bar in October of 95 through the date she left Minnesota in February of 2000, noting that this period amounts to 4.5 years and falls short of the 5 years required by Minnesota Rule 7A, which is used in this case because it's more stringent than Wisconsin's. The rest of the decision analyzed whether or not the unlicensed time should count towards proof of practice. The Rule Petition 1609 has not received any comments in opposition, only great support, including from Governor Walker himself. The Rule Petition has generated thoughtful and helpful suggestions that have been incorporated into the rule before the court, and frankly has improved it and showed the value of the process. The final language before the court is contained in the August 10th, 2017 letter to the court from Supreme Court Commissioner Julianne Rich.
Mr. Puz, in the original petition, you stated our state neighbors who have federally recognized Indian tribes acknowledge practice in federal Indian law as legitimate practice, leaving Wisconsin as a notable outlier. If you'll recall, we request that you provide language of rules or court opinions that would address how they handled this question. And I'm looking at a letter dated March 8, 2017. There's nothing in there. Were you able to come up with any language from our state neighbors, either by rule or court opinions, that address how they handle practice with Indian tribes?
No, Justice Kelly. Their rules are very similar to Wisconsin's, which on its face would not bar this practice. Unfortunately, it's the Helgemo decision and the misinterpretation and misapplication of it that has resulted in Wisconsin being an outlier in how it treats practice in front of tribal governments.
But you you suggested in your petition that our state neighbors actually do interpret their rules the way you want us to interpret ours. Were you able to find any evidence of that at all?
Only with talking with practitioners that have gone across the border. I myself was licensed in Minnesota. I'm a Minnesota grad and came into Wisconsin. And I haven't had that issue. Other attorneys haven't had that issue, but the ones that haven't were practicing in outside law firms, doing the same work as in-house attorneys, serving tribal governments, but was coming from an outside practice experience. And the Helgemo rules never applied to our applications. But when it was in-house practice, because of the way the court analyzed the non-licensed practice before tribal governments, those attorneys were caught by that decision. And we were simply hoping to codify the Supreme Court's decision in Helgemo into the rule to make it clear that that is the intent of how the rule should be read and applied.
So if I'm understanding you correctly then, if we were to codify the Helgemo ruling into our rules, that would make us an outlier, correct?
Only in the fact that you've acknowledged in the actual language of your rule what your court has already decided in its decision making.
Are you done, Justice Kelly?
Yes, thank you.
You made reference to Ms. Rich's letter, and I assume it's the one of June 29, 2017, in which she advised you of what the Board of Bar Examiners is going to propose.
Actually, it's the August 10th, 2017 letter to the court.
And what did that say? And my real question, my bottom line is, okay, I've got that too. So, which talks to you again about the BBA report and what it says. So, are you in favor of Ms. Rothstein's redraft of your petition?
Yes, the August 10th letter reports to the court that there was a conference call between the tribe and BBE.
Right.
And all were in agreement with BBE's proposed.
All right,
changes.
And that's really no different than the June 29th letter. I mean,
right.
That
in
has
the
to say in the language of this. I have a question about this. One, just so you know where I'm coming from, I favor treating practice with a tribe or practice in tribal courts as practicing law when the lawyer is licensed in the state, let's forget about double states or triple states, when the lawyer is licensed in the state in which the tribal court sits. And that's the purpose of, I think, and Ms. Rothstein can say if I'm wrong, of her amendments.
Yes, Justice.
Right. So it treats lawyers in tribal courts the same as lawyers in federal court or in Minnesota state court or any other state court?
Yes.
Okay. I favor that. My originally, when I read your proposal, it seemed to deal with admitting lawyers only on the basis of their being, for for lack of a better word, employees of the tribe. So they could be prosecutors in the tribe or defense counsel in the tribe or tribal judges or tribal law clerks, et cetera. This is much broader. You can represent a private citizen in the tribe and be admitted under this rule. I favor that. Do you?
He supports the rule.
Or don't you read the rule that way?
I think the redraft by the BBE did make it slightly broader than the original rule petition. But it still requires practice in front of a federally recognized tribe and licensure in the state where the tribe is located.
Right, exactly. So, and I will ask this of Ms. Rothstein, so you may not want to leave it to her. In 40.05 sub 3, it says the following activities, whether or not conducted in a state or territory, the federal government or the District of Columbia, where the applicant was admitted, may be deemed a practice of the law. Practice of law. Do we have to add tribal there? I'm not sure. That's my one question. And my other question is, under 3E, it says legal service or service as a judge with any federally recognized Indian tribe judge. Should that be not an in, a with, but an in? Because with is what caused problems the last in your draft. So you may not be in the position to answer that, counsel, since you're not the drafter here of this. But I'm not trying to narrow this. I'm trying to make it say what I think we have agreed it should say. So my understanding is you are satisfied with 40.05 as drafted by the BBE.
Yes, Justice.
Okay.
Are there any other questions?
Do you have any disagreement with adding tribal judges to the apparently now amended petition?
No,
where
Justice
would
Bradley.
You add it, Justice?
It's in the Bradley. It's, I don't know, it's on sub E. I don't have it.
Well, 3E uses the word judge. Is that where you would put tribal before that? I'm just trying to follow your comment.
Okay, this is what was requested by Judge Nielsen on behalf of the forum. And now everyone, as I understand it, has unanimity, and that's why I want to make sure my understanding is correct. Unanimity with regard to the proposed amendment.
Yes, there's no issue on behalf of the tribe with adding practicing as a judge before the tribe to the rule.
3E?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Now, did the Legislative Reference Bureau see Ms. Rothstein's? No. Okay. Thank you. I always try and check for the Legislative Reference Bureau to see if they've made any suggestions, and I didn't find them, and I've been signaled they haven't. So thank you. And I note that July 21, Justice Bradley has already picked up the E, we should look at the other one that I raised. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Director of Board Bar Examiners, Jacqueline Rothstein.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I'm here today to speak in favor of the proposed rule petition 1609 to amend Supreme Court Rule 40.05, which, as you're aware, would amend our proof of practice provision to allow legal services with any federally recognized Indian tribe to be counted for the purposes of SCR 40.05, and that governs admission to practice law in Wisconsin based on an individual's admission to practice law and the active practice of law in a qualifying jurisdiction. I agree with Attorney Puz. We did work together to make these amendments. We are in agreement with them, and we hope that the rule will be adopted by the court.
There were two suggestions made from the bench in regard to 40.05.3E, and one was from Justice Bradley, who suggested before the word judge, tribal should be added.
I didn't suggest that. I don't think it's needed. Legal services or services as a judge with any federal recognized Indian tribe, I think.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood your comment because you questioned the first witness about adding judge. So just skip that then. And
yes.
Then Justice Abrahamson thought perhaps in the same section, the word with any federally recognized Indian tribe would be better expressed as in any federally recognized Indian tribe?
I don't have a strong opinion about that.
I think
either way would probably be workable, and if in is better, we can certainly agree to that.
Well, the reason I was disturbed was because with, as used in the original petition, referred in effect to an in-house counsel. So you worked with them. And that triggered my looking. And if you look at the material here, there's a great deal of emphasis on using the word with. So that, when I saw the word with, it triggered my issue about this. And so I think, put in, it's legal services in.
Now, if
and service as a judge in.
In. All right. Yeah. That's what you're
suggesting.
That's
what I would suggest.
We'll talk about
it. And I don't know to the extent to which, sort of like other courts do, which will assign a someone who's not an official judge to serve as a judge, and that's why I don't know that I'd put in tribal, but I'd think about that. What do you think?
I think the change from with to in would be acceptable and sensible. I think that works.
Okay. And this has not gone to the Legislative Reference Bureau, so...
That's my understanding, correct.
Okay. So they may have it. Now, what about under subsection 3, Ms. Rothstein? The following activities, whether or not conducted in the state or territory, the federal government or the D.C., where the applicant was admitted to practice law, may be deemed to be the practice of law. Service as a judge, legal service with, there's with. Legal service in the armed services, teaching in any law school, legal service or service as a judge with any federally recognized Indian tribe. Do we need to have in the Indian tribe or in tribal in sub 3?
I'm not following that question.
Well, the list is state, territory, federal government, or District of Columbia in sub 3. Do we have to put tribal recognized, federally recognized Indian tribe? I think not, but because it was missing, it was bothered me. It's in 1B.
Well, I think perhaps.
See, so that I just want to make sure that it fits. And in my own mind, I couldn't clear. Obviously, do tribes admit people to practice law?
I don't know the answer to
sure.
that.
Sure.
All right.
Is in subparagraph 3, that's referring to the jurisdictions in which the applicant is admitted to practice, right?
In sub 3, it talks about the nature of the practice. And so if you go to sub C, we have included the addition there, sub E, of legal right. service or service as a judge with any federally recognized tribe.
Yeah. So before we get to the subparagraphs of 3, I think the language to which Justice Abrahamson was referring, whether or not conducted in the state or territory and so on, that's referring to where the applicant was admitted to practice law. So I'm not sure it would make sense to refer to a federally recognized Indian tribe at that point.
Right.
Right?
I agree, correct.
Well, you just move it to after the comma before May. That's a technical drafting thing. It is.
No, is there, well, and this might be just an area of my ignorance. So do the federally recognized Indian tribes formally admit people to practice?
Yes. Attorney Paz says yes, and I take him at
sure.
his word.
Let's say that's true. So so are we, in this paragraph 3, before we get to the subparagraphs, are we interested in referring to applicants who are admitted to practice before an Indian tribe?
That was not part of our discussion. The nature of the discussion was ensuring licensure in another jurisdiction.
Right, because if we referred to a federally recognized Indian tribe in paragraph 3, then we would be potentially admitting attorneys to practice in Wisconsin who are not admitted to any other state or federal court and so on.
I believe that to be true, yes.
Yeah. That's not what we're interested in doing with this rule.
That was not the intent, correct.
Right.
Okay.
Well, also, isn't it true that there are folks who are admitted to practice before tribal courts who are not lawyers?
Correct.
Okay. Well, but you see, sub 3 says whether or not conducted in a state in which they're admitted. So it doesn't matter if they're admitted in a tribal project.
Our emphasis is state licensure, and that was the emphasis of the petitioner from the get-go, as I understand it. That is, from the get-go, all the petitioner wanted to deal with was in-house counsel for tribes and wanted to emphasize that the in-house counsel had to be licensed to practice in another state or in the federal government or the district, I guess, the licensed in another state.
That's taken care of by 1A.
Mm-hmm.
An applicant has to satisfy all the following. A, proof of admission to practice law in a court of last resort in any other state or territory or D.C. B, substantially engaged in the practice of law. And then 2 and 3 talk about what's the practice of law. So you're taking care that they're admitted in a state or in a territory in A, not in 3.
Are there other questions? Thank you very much.
That's drafted, isn't it?
I beg your pardon?
I said, I think that's how this is drafted. As I stated, it's taken care of in 1A.
Yes, you do have to have a license
exactly.
in another jurisdiction under this provision. That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nicole Homer?
Madam Chief Justice, other justices, may it please the court. Saguli, that's hello in the Oneida language.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here today to provide my verbal support due to the fact that there was the letter that has just been referenced, the August 10th, 2017 letter When I provided my letter of support as the chair of the Indian Law Section of the State Bar of Wisconsin, that predated this letter. So I'm here today to provide oral support for this new amended language that we do believe is necessary to continue to grow as the Indian Law Section of the State Bar of Wisconsin. I myself work with the Ho-Chunk Nation as in-house counsel. I can state that we indeed do have our own bar admission policies. We at Ho-Chunk
do you limit it? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but do you limit it to members of the bar of a state, or can you be not admitted in a state and still be admitted in the tribal court?
So within the Ho-Chunk Nation,
yes.
You can be admitted as an attorney, but you can also indeed be a lay advocate that has been required to go through lay advocacy training. Our bar is required. The Ho-Chunk Nation decided to adopt the state rules of Wisconsin as our rules of ethics. So we do have to abide by those rules when practicing within the Ho-Chunk Nation.
Even if you're a lay?
Even if you're a lay advocate, correct. Our main concern is that we are a very transient bunch.
Who isn't these days?
Correct. I myself grew up just off of the Onondaga Reservation in New York, went to undergrad in Washington, D.C., went to law school in New Orleans, Louisiana, and then found myself in Wisconsin. With the goal of focusing on Indian law, since I am a tribal member with the Oneida of the Thames in Ontario, Canada. We oftentimes have to look to other states in the event that we do find ourselves without employment. It is a specialized field in the sense that, you know, we are a tight-knit group that learns a special type of law, but the reality is I think I practice more in state court systems than I do in the tribal court system. I do a lot of Indian Child Welfare Act cases. We have a housing program, for example, where I've done foreclosures in the state court system and also done a tremendous amount of small claims, for example. So I actually could honestly state that I spent more time within a state court than I do the tribal court. So it is important for us to come to these positions with an understanding of underlying state law, and obviously we want to protect the sanctity of the job, so we would like to see that, you know, there are rules in place, but we don't want to see those rules inhibiting our continued advancement within the field of Indian law. So if there are no other questions, I would just say again that we do support the new language as presented in the August 10th letter and believe that this is an important rule to both help Indian lawyers but also to protect the public interest of Wisconsin.
Thank you for taking the time to come. It's always nice to have someone who is actively engaged, as you are, an Oneida member, but now working for the Ho-Chunk Nation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I have a question for you. Do you have any sense about whether with is better than in, and any sense about whether we should add tribal courts in the introductory comments in 3?
And
601 and
if you wanted to make it more similar, I would say almost that you could have legal service with any federally recognized Indian tribe or service as a judge of a federally recognized tribe, just because they say of in sub A.
That leaves you in trouble about legal service. You'll have to have a preposition there. The first part, legal service in, was service as a judge of. Okay, thank you. Good.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who hasn't notified me yet who would like to speak on petition 1609? All right, then this concludes our hearing. We will meet in closed conference at 5 minutes after 11.